to the 2012 series of Vinegar Lectures. How refreshing it is to see so many people packed in such a small room. Delightful that our lecturer today has stimulated such interest. Our lecture series this year is entitled Environmental Governance and Resilience. I think there's widespread agreement that the rate and the magnitude of environmental change is sufficient.
Thank you.
That it warrants immediate action. And immediate action not only involves political will, but it may also involve scientific innovation. Resilience ecology maintains that much of that innovation will come through examining the interplay between social and ecological sciences, and that the disciplinary boxes in which those currently exist may well inhibit the process of developing sustainable solutions for the future. So our contributors to this series of lectures will engage resilience thinking in order to examine how social and biological elements combine and interact and may ultimately lead to the design of new sustainability solutions. Our lecturer today is Kerry Chapin. Kerry is Professor of Ecology at the Department of Biology and Wildlife at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. You can gauge the level of experience that he has in the field of biology by hearing that he graduated as a biologist in the same year that England last won the World Cup. Terry then spent a couple of years in the Peace Corps in Bogota, in Colombia, and then went off to Stanford, where he earned his PhD in biological sciences, examining plant-nutrient relationships, I understand, back in 1973. His research today focuses on the effects of environmental change on Alaskan ecology and rural communities. He's especially interested in ways of increasing long-term sustainability of ecosystems and human communities in spite of rapid climate change and social changes. And of course, his focus on polar regions is particularly appropriate since they are so vulnerable. Terry was the first Alaskan to be elected to the US National Academy of Sciences, and is a lead professor in the University of Alaska's interdisciplinary program in resilience and adaptation. His talk today is Social Ecological Resilience, a framework for stewardship in an uncertain and rapidly changing planet.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to come here. I'm particularly excited about being at Oxford because I was here on sabbatical in 1979. And so it's fun to come home. And also because I really have a strong commitment to the notion of interdisciplinary exchange of ideas and the idea of being in a place where the college system is so strong as it is here at Oxford. It's a real interesting opportunity for me to engage in dialogue with all of you. So I'd like to talk about sustainability strategies in a rapidly changing planet. Oftentimes when we think about sustainability, we think of keeping things the same. And yet, with the way the world is changing, this is not an easy option anymore. If we look at the last 100,000 years, you can see that there's been lots of environmental change. Here's the temperature variation during the last glaciation. And one of the things that's really striking about our current interglacial period, the Holocene, is not only that it's warmer than during the ice ages, but it also it's been incredibly stable. This has been the time, it's only after this period of stability that we've got the beginnings of agriculture, the development of all of the great European and Oriental civilizations. And even during this period of stability, if we have minor wiggles in the temperature regime, this has resulted in major societal disruption, extinction of human populations, and so forth. And now, if you look at the black line, we're clearly moving outside of the zone of Holocene stability. So this raises real questions in my mind about the future of people with respect to the rest of the planet. We know a lot about the causes of these changes in temperature and changes in climate. It's driven by population consumption and wealth and our use of resources. It causes many different environmental changes, and it coincides with many other kinds of ecological changes that are also important, such as land conversion, species extinction, and exploitation of fisheries. What's interesting about these graphs to me is that they're all basically identical, and they show a massive increase since the mid-20th century. And projections are that many of these processes are likely to follow a similar trajectory into the future unless society makes some major adjustments to our way of life. So it strikes me that it's a really important time to think about the relationship between society and the natural world. And I think it's useful to think of people as being part of nature. Typically, we're used to thinking of ecology as being one discipline and one set of processes, and the social sciences very incorporating another set of disciplines and processes that interact with one another. But I think we need to come up with a much more integrated approach of thinking about people as part of nature, and to think about some of our responsibilities as citizens with respect to being part of nature. We're approaching tipping points in the functioning of the Earth system. I think it's clear that in many respects, the Earth will transform or is transforming. And so it's not a choice of whether or not this is going to happen. It's a question. It's more of a question of how can we shape these changes? How can we shape these transitions, these transformations, in a way that moves us toward a trajectory that's more sustainable, rather than just letting transformations happen to us because we're not prepared to engage in these issues. So it's an enormous challenge, and we certainly don't know enough of the science to know how to do this in a prescriptive way. But we also don't have the luxury of waiting until we figure out the science to an adequate point. We really need to act now before the science is completely ready. Also, it's not someone else's problem. As ecologists, it's very much in our domain, in that human ecology and human actions are at the core not only of the problems, but inevitably also in the solutions. So we need to be actively engaging in these issues. And we need to improve our basic understanding of the social ecological processes and how we can apply this understanding of social ecological interconnections and processes to exploring solutions. But it's also something that's much larger than ecology. It inevitably has to be an interdisciplinary effort. It needs to bring together practitioners as well as academics to address these issues. But given those trajectories, it's probably one of the most exciting times in science for at least a century. So it's a really exciting time to come to grips with many of these challenges. So by Earth stewardship, I mean the active shaping of pathways of change in social ecological systems to enhance ecosystem resilience and human well-being. And in my view, this is one of the big challenges, is moving forward with Earth stewardship. It has several key features. First of all, it involves active intervention, and that's necessarily risky because it's the every time people have attempted to intervene in natural systems, we've realized that our understanding is incomplete and the outcomes are not always favorable. So it's risky, and it's best justified at scales that are small enough that we can have some hope of fixing the problem or trying alternative solutions in other places. It involves shaping change rather than just sitting by and letting change happen. It is inherently an issue of people as part of nature rather than thinking of these as two separate sets of disciplines. And I think there's two goals that are equally important. One is ecosystem resilience or ecological integrity, and the other is human well-being. And so as for me as an ecologist, I find myself thinking about human well-being as being just as important a goal in this sort of effort as I do the ecological outcomes that that I might like to see. So it's not a question of people or nature, but figuring out how we can think about people as part of nature. So how do we go about doing this? There's several traditional approaches to motivating stewardship. The traditional approach, I suppose, is regulations that constrain unsustainable behavior so that people take actions and interact with the planet in ways that are as sustainable as possible. Another approach that's become of increasing interest to ecologists is that involved with ecosystem services and providing some degree of economic valuation of the benefits that people derive from ecosystems. I think this has been important because many of these ecosystem services have not been adequately valued or considered as we begin to make decisions about trade-offs among alternative approaches, alternative policies. But using market approaches like this, I think is probably important but insufficient. We can subsidize sustainable behavior, we can align economic incentives with sustainability goals, but I think we need to move beyond economic motivations and regulations. And one approach that I'm finding increasingly intriguing, but one which I am only beginning to understand how to use in a policy framework, has to do with sense of place. Thinking about self-motivation for environmental stewardship and environmental citizenship. I think in many cases, people do the right things not just because of fear of punishment or because of economic motivations, but because they really care about some aspect of the environment around them or the culture around them. And so I think if we can find ways in which to tap this sense of place, this sense of environmental responsibility, that it could be a really powerful motivation for shifting things towards a more sustainable trajectory. It's a much more of a grassroots approach than regulations or than depending on market mechanisms. But sense of place is a really complex set of interactions. It involves the biophysical attributes of a particular place. It involves personal and psychological responses of individuals to different kinds of places. It also involves social, ideological, and cultural perspectives of groups of people or communities about particular places. And it involves the political and economic context in which issues get framed. So there's no simple way in which we can just say, aha, sense of place is going to take us to stewardship. And in fact, in many cases, sense of place isn't particularly helpful in moving towards stewardship. Many people will, in a particular place, will have different sets of values, different things they value about a place, and therefore different modes of different policies, different actions that they would promote. So, for example, loggers or miners who live in a particular area, that may be an important part of their identity, of who they are, how they relate to particular places. And I can't say that my sense of place for that particular place is necessarily inherently better or worse than theirs might be, which might motivate a different set of actions. So if we have these conflicting senses of place, how can we use this to make progress? Usually, if people do have a sense of attachment to place, a sense of place, there are certain aspects of place that about which people agree. So, for example, in the western parts of the United States, being close to mountains is an important motivation, important component of sense of place. There's other aspects of those places that about which people disagree. But if we can identify the common sources of attachment to place, then we've got a good starting point. And there's fairly straightforward methodologies for finding out those points of agreement. And then I think the other part of it is then negotiating acceptable solutions on issues that about which people disagree, over which conflicts arise, as to how people should interact with place. So now we can sort of subdivide issues of sense of place into points of agreement and points of disagreement. And so what I'd like to do next is to give you three examples of case studies from New Zealand where sense of place was an important motivation to move towards stewardship. One is a small catchment in southeast New Zealand, the Waikawa catchment. It's an area that was cleared beginning in about 1850 and converted to raising sheep. It's logging in the upper reaches of the catchment has continued since then. But about 10 or 20 years ago, people realized that the estuaries where they would go to fish recreationally or for subsistence no longer supported the fish that they used to go out there as families to catch. And this was a real cause of concern because that was an important part of what they valued about living in this place. And so there began to be discussions about why this was, and these discussions were facilitated by a local facilitator. And over a period of a year or two, people came to realize that pollution was a problem, sedimentation was a problem, and so they agreed on steps that could be taken that would reduce pollution, would reduce erosion along the riverbanks, and they moved towards a much stronger, a much more sustainable trajectory in terms of management of water quality and management of sediment yields. And this is a relatively small catchment, so each landowner represented themselves in this discussion and negotiation. They all had there was a relatively homogeneous set of values about what they valued about this place, and they came to agreement relatively easily. It was mainly an issue of identifying the problem and finding a solution. Another example that was much more complicated has to do with the Fiordland's marine reserves in western southwestern New Zealand, and this one was an area where that had been fished commercially for quite some time. It had been an area that was slow to be developed for its fisheries because it was more remote and more stormy than other parts of New Zealand. But nonetheless, several of the major fishery stocks were sequentially depleted. And then there was improvement of road transportation so that it was possible for recreational fishers to get into the area. There was a diversion of cruise ships from the Middle East to New Zealand because of political unrest in the Middle East. And so lots of concern about the future of the remaining fisheries in this place and all of the various stakeholder groups, which were much more complex than that previous case, agreed that they really cared about this place and they didn't want to see it destroyed. And so they began a process of negotiation that was organized by local stakeholders. So it was another grassroots effort. And in this case, there were people who represented a broader body of stakeholders. So they not only had to communicate with their other people in their stakeholder group, but they also had to engage in dialogue with other stakeholders. And they made a, they, there was a skilled facilitator that kept people at the table. They were committed to finding a solution. They realized that they weren't going to come up with a solution unless they had a set of ground rules for compromise. So they developed a set of ground rules that by which any stakeholder group that got some benefit from a negotiated part of this settlement had to give up something that they also cared about. And so this, they set a, there were a set of ground rules for interaction that worked. And they worked out a solution. They presented it to government. Government codified this in law. And this is now the way in which this marine fjordland area is managed. And it's also widely looked at as being an example for the way in which natural resources could be managed in other parts of New Zealand. So it wasn't a top-down managed thing by government, but it was involved a grassroots effort, but it was much more difficult and required something on the order of 5 years to work out a reasonable set of policies. The third example is two lakes, Lake Manapouri and Tiano, that are the gateway to the Fjordlands National Park System in southwest New Zealand. And there was a hydropower development set up to provide power to an aluminum smelter, which was intended to keep population, maintain an economy in southern New Zealand, and stop the population drift to the north. And the first phase of this involved redirecting the second largest river in New Zealand through a set of tunnels into a fjord. The second phase of this development was to involve raising and lowering by some 24 meters these two major lakes that were the gateway to this national park. And New Zealand as a nation sort of rose up in arms at the idea of disrupting their most iconic piece of scenery. And so there was a major write-in campaign and efforts to, and this resulted in a change of government and set up a group of some 20 different stakeholder groups to negotiate a solution. And they worked at this for about 10 years before they came up with a solution. And everybody had to compromise in coming up with this solution. But in the end, each one of these 20 stakeholder groups agreed to abide by the agreement, and so that it went forward. So here was another situation where sense of place, this time at a national scale, was important and motivated a shift towards stewardship. But being a much more complex set of issues and taking place at a larger scale, the sets of interactions were much more diffuse, and it was much more difficult to negotiate a final outcome. So with respect to sense of place, I think that regulations and economic incentives are important but an insufficient motivation for stewardship, and that sense of place can provide a third alternative. But we need to know much more about when sense of place can be used effectively as to move along a trajectory towards stewardship. Another thing I might mention is that each of these is a local case. We have a global problem. Can we ever use these sorts of local efforts to come up with an aggregated shift towards more sustainable behavior by society? And one thing is that I think each of us is in a situation where we know one or more local places very well. We know the issues of that place. We know the people who are in a position to make decisions in those places. We know the social networks that tie people together or that create disagreements. And so I think if each of us is motivated to go to some place that we care about, we're probably, each of us have some particular set of skills and knowledge that would enable those places to move towards more sustainable trajectories. So I think part of it is a question of each of us thinking about some places that we care about and being motivated and taking the responsibility to move those towards more sustainable solutions. I'd like to mention just a few examples from Alaska and then a couple of globally common examples. In Alaska, this is the last century of temperature record, and you can see it's been warming over the last 40 years, and it's projected to continue warming for the rest of the century. The projections for mid-century, that's 40 years from now, are that the average temperatures at that time are about the same as the warmest temperatures we've experienced any time in the historical record. And by the end of the century, the coolest years are going to be similar in temperature, are projected to be similar in temperature to the warmest years that we've seen historically. So each of you has a sense of what a warm year is and what a cold year is. You know the large difference between those. And so these really are massive temperature changes that should be possible to communicate to a broader audience. And some things are already happening. Sea ice is retreating, so that the summer extent of sea ice has been moving northward. In 2007, for the first time, the walruses off the coast of Alaska moved onshore away from these nursing platforms on sea ice because all of the ice had drifted north of the shelf break and it was too deep for them to feed. So they had no choice but to abandon the ice and move to shore. That was in 2007. It's happened three more times since then. The ecology of these animals is clearly changing. And there's many of the communities in northern Alaska, they're all but one are coastal. All of them are heavily connected culturally to harvesting marine mammals. So this is not only an ecological but a cultural issue. In interior Alaska, where I live, things have been getting warmer and drier, and this has resulted in more extensive forest fires. And also these forest fires have been burning more deeply, so that it now often burns away the entire peat layer and forms a mineral soil seedbed, which gives rise to a different set of tree species that colonize. So the chances are that within the next few decades, what has in the past, well, for the last 6,000 years, been a conifer-dominated biome is likely to shift to becoming a deciduous forest-dominated biome. That has lots of implications for climate feedbacks, for the ecology of the areas, and so forth. This is a pair of maps that my wife pointed out to me. Here's a map of the vegetation of Alaska. Here's a map of the language groups of Alaska. You can see that they're virtually identical because people are very closely adapted, indigenous people are very closely adapted to the environments where they've lived over the last several thousand years and because they've shaped those environments. So what I've just told you is that the ecology of these of the state of Alaska is changing radically. And for me, the biggest, the most critical issue is what does this mean for the indigenous cultures of Alaska. One of the things I really enjoyed doing is working closely with some of these people. They depend a lot on their local environment for wood, for hunting animals, for fishing. Most of the villages in rural Alaska have no road connection and are disconnected from the electrical grids from the rest of the state. So they're connected to the rest of the state by runways or by rivers. So they're very much dependent on the environment immediately around them. So one of the sets of discussions we've had has been to realize that any particular ecological issue, such as climate change, needs to be framed in a much broader perspective. So for people in this one particular community, for example, they're chief main immediate concern is that the cost of fuel oil has doubled in the last 2 or 3 years. This is the area of the most widespread poverty in terms of income anywhere in the United States. So it's also the area with the highest prices of fuel anywhere in the United States. So it's a major issue for them in order to be able to get out hunting, to be able to heat their homes and so forth. So we've been discussing various ways in which local fuels, wood, could be burned for heating and potentially for electricity generation. And just from initial studies, it seems like in many of these communities it would be ecologically sustainable, economically viable. And the biggest cost of this is the wages required to cut the wood. And those would be money that would be retained locally in communities where there's very few wage-paying jobs. So there's many different ways in which this might become ecologically and socially beneficial if it's looked at as a broader problem. Now, I have to confess that I didn't do a very good job of managing this dialogue with this community, because I brought this in as a potential solution, and the community was not interested in taking it on. Now, in other communities, in similar ecological situations, they've had this idea themselves, and they've gone out and pursued it and put it into place. So it's partly an issue of coming up with good solutions, but it's also an issue of engaging communities on their terms to come up with jointly co-developed solutions. I'm just beginning a social experiment, which is something that makes me very nervous. Working with several communities in rural Alaska to try to implement their visions for self-reliance, to become more self-reliant and be able to be more empowered to chart their own direction forward. In talking with Native leaders in the area, they've told me things that I would never have dared say. They've said, we think it's highly likely that most of the villages of rural Alaska are going to disappear within the next 2 decades because of rising costs and disappearance of various government subsidies. And without those, with the current patterns of people, their economic options, the way in which they interact with their environments, they're unlikely to be able to make a go of it. So the biggest issue that they saw facing Native cultures in Alaska was coming up with ways to become more self-reliant. So they identified some 10 different communities that they thought were extremely innovative. We invited them to participate in this experiment to look for ways to implement their vision of self-reliance. And 4 of those communities have decided to join with us on this. And so what we're going to do is learn from them what their visions of self-reliance are, and then take various research groups at the University of Alaska to see what they can offer to implement these community visions of self-reliance. So it's taking the resources of the university and applying it to a community-developed set of issues rather than a university agenda going out to work with communities. One of these communities has developed rural agriculture and greenhouses and is setting up agriculture as an economic base. Another of these communities is getting washed into the ocean by coastal erosion with the disappearance of sea ice, and they're relocating the community to a new location, which means an opportunity to rebuild their community in a very different, hopefully more sustainable fashion. Another community is interested in language rejuvenation. Another is pursuing multiple pathways of community engagement to sort of strengthen a sense of community. So each of these has a different vision, and I think it's going to be fascinating to see how this comes out. I'm not optimistic that all of these are going to succeed, but I think it's going to be an interesting experiment to start out with their visions of what they think is likely to work for them. So those are some examples of stewardship issues and the way I see them playing out in Alaska. Here's another set of issues, stewardship issues, that play out commonly across the globe. Sustainable transformations of cities, it's a tremendous opportunity given the massive migration of people into cities. Sustaining cultural and biological diversity in their interaction, meeting the needs of people for food and water while maintaining environmental quality, managing uncertainty and transformations, fostering environmental citizenship, we've already talked about, more effective communication of science with society, and developing governance at global scales. So I'm just going to mention one or two of these. Managing transformations is one of the ones that I find most intriguing because I'm least certain about how to do that. I think for many of these issues, there's ways in which people have thought about how to reduce environmental impact of agriculture, for example. Social ecological systems exist in multiple alternative states, and as the environment moves directionally, as it appears to be doing, it's more likely that that many of these systems are going to transform. And so we need to think about ways in which we can manage these transformations through development of social networks that communicate the issues at critical times in transition by identifying potential pathways and having dialogues about the trade-offs among those potential pathways, by various other sorts of ways of thinking about the trade-offs and the opportunities for strengthening pathways that do that a particular group decides are worth pursuing. So we need, I think we need to develop a science of transformation. And in a sense, this is practical problems, but in a sense, it's an area in desperate need of theoretical development. And I find it a really exciting area on both of those grounds. Let me just mention a couple of things about one particular example of transformation that occurred in the United States after Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans. After this, there's several possible outcomes that might be pursued, either persistence of the same system of or actively navigated transformation to some alternative system that might be socially more desirable, or a decision not to do anything and just let it happen to you. And so then issues of, there's various frameworks for thinking about vulnerability, adaptability, and resilience that provide guidelines for thinking about how you can move from change, from drivers of change to this system, to the way in which that influences the sensitivity of the system, the responses of the system, which in turn influences the internal dynamics of the system. And I'm not going to go through the details of it, but just to say that there are some theoretical frameworks that we can start from that begin to let us think about transformation. As a broad strategy for Earth stewardship, I think we need to build the science and then think about how to apply the science to sustainability issues. Part of this is engaging strategic stakeholders. I think the problem is serious enough and the time scale urgent enough that we can't hope to convince everybody that this is an important direction to take. But we can find strategic stakeholders that are more likely than not to make a difference. And I think one group that's particularly important to engage in this is students, because it's your world. You often are the ones that have the passion to really make the time investment, the investment of energy to make these things happen. So I think that's a really crucial group to work with, at least in the Ecological Society of America. The major reason that most students decided to become ecologists was because of environmental concerns rather than because of an intellectual interest in the discipline. Not that they were disinterested in the theoretical aspects, but they were strongly motivated about the environmental issues. I've been working with communities, with religious communities in the United States, as a group of messengers of issues that are all a group of people that are concerned about issues of stewardship. That's very much part of their vocabulary, and who are capable of reaching a much broader part of the political spectrum than I think the scientific community is likely to reach. It's been a very slow pattern of developing trust and working out patterns of dialogue, and it's still early stages in this, but I think that's another group where is worth engaging in dialogue. Businesses are another group that I think is often interested in knowing how they can contribute. Practitioners and policymakers are people that ecologists and social scientists have always worked with. I think we need to think about the relationship between science and society much more as in terms of dialogue rather than in conveying of information. I think, at least speaking for ecologists, we've tended to view the issue as one of information deficit rather than an issue of public engagement. And so I think we need to redefine the way in which we think about communication between science and society, and focusing on more on solutions and less on problems. At some point, I think this needs to become a social movement. I don't think the role of science is to be part of that social movement necessarily, but we can do a lot to provide, to inform the decisions that the broader public might choose to pursue. And again, I think the issue is partnering with appropriate messengers and finding ways that science can link to action more effectively than it has in the past. So I think we can substantially improve the relationship between society and the biosphere, and I think stewardship provides some guidelines for sustainability in times of rapid change. And there's lots of ways in which each one of us can contribute through the science that we do, through our educational mission, through our interaction with the public. But it's going to require a commitment to seeking solutions as being part of our professional responsibilities. And I think it's something that we all need to engage in sooner rather than later. Thank you.